Good morning, dear listeners. Welcome to the Whistleblower Newsroom. I'm here with Celia Farber, my co-host. I'm Christina Borgeson, and today we have a guest who will light your hair on fire because he's lit mine on fire with his book. Luke Rosiak, he's an investigative reporter after our own heart, Celia, because he doesn't do left or right, he just does the truth. And if anyone has any illusions about the collective corruption of Congress or questions about whether or not the Dems and Republicans are in bed together when it comes to covering up their own corruption, Luke Rosiak's book, Obstruction of Justice, How the Deep State Risked National Security to Protect the Democrats, will shatter those illusions and answer the questions in painfully gritty detail. His book, honestly.
Yeah, Christina called me up and she said, Oh my God.
I mean, I'm just going to read from the flap of this book before we bring Luke on. And by the way, Luke knows, you know, something about government, because he actually, before he became an investigative reporter for Daily Caller News Foundation, he was an investigator for the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. So, you know, he knows his way around government. And, you know, he's also written for Washington Post, Washington Examiner, and Washington Times. So he's a guy who, you know, he's a professional. And he wrote this book that just blew my mind. Everybody talks about how Congress is corrupt, but when you don't get the details, just sort of an amorphous thing in your
details.
Head.
Yeah, we love details.
And the story that he uncovered is the story about how during the 2016 election, there was a family of unvetted Pakistani nationals headed by their patriarch Imran Awan, who gained access to the computer files of 1 in 5 Democrats in the House of Representatives. They lifted data off the House network, stole the identity of an intelligence specialist, and sent congressional electronic equipment to foreign officials. And that was only the beginning. The other thing they did was he would order stuff using these congressional accounts, these congresspeople's accounts, and, you know, computers and things. And then he would, I guess, steal them and sell them. I mean, it's crazy.
Virtually all but absent from the media.
Yes, dialectic. Well, Congress and the Justice Department moved to cover up a politically inconvenient hack, and the supposed watchdogs in the media turned a blind eye. But we're going to hear all about this from Luke. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, I don't even know. Just tell me, how did you fall into this story?
Well, I think it was kind of during Trump's inauguration when everyone else in Washington was distracted. There was a little story that came out in Politico, and it said that some IT guys in Congress had gotten in trouble, but no one was quite sure what they had done. They did something bad, but yet they weren't arrested, and also they were all brothers. There was like 3 or 4 of them. And so, you know, this is coming pretty recently after the whole DNC hack, and me being a former computer programmer, I'm interested in computers, and I said, that's an interesting story, a hack in government. I mean, I think we're, you know, cybersecurity, we've been told for the last 6 months, is a huge deal. Surely this is a big news story. And apparently no one else felt that way because, it was, I guess, maybe Democrats or, you know, were the employers of these IT guys, or they just didn't feel like it fit in the Russian narrative, or they had just moved on from the Russia thing and they wanted to go after Trump. But I legitimately thought that, you know, when the DNC was hacked and Democrats said that, you know, our nation is under assault, cybersecurity is basically an act of war, you know, that's more or less true. I mean, cybersecurity is a big deal. We shouldn't have people hacking the government. And
right.
So, you know, I approached this as a story about the cybersecurity and the role it plays these days in national security. And I started looking into it. And I know people on Capitol Hill. I started working sources. And people were very, very scared about this situation. They were enormously secretive about it. And that's, as a reporter, that made me realize from very early on that something big was going on.
Right.
And when I learned the names of these people, and, you know, if people have heard about it a little bit in the media, they may know it as the Awan brothers, Imran Awan. So that was the name of these people. And after that, the story, it became clear pretty quickly that this was a big story, because once I knew their names, which no one else knew, I looked them up in court records and so on, and I found that they had, you know, million-dollar bankruptcies. They had, like, a dozen, like, sham, like, shell companies, like LLCs that they were creating. They had been sued, like, dozens of times by different people who were saying that they were being threatened and extorted and swindled by them. And, you know, you could see that they had lied on their congressional ethics disclosures to hide quite a bit of money. You know, basically, these were bad people, and it was pretty clear that something big was going on. And so that was kind of the thing, is that this originated during a time when everyone was obsessed with Trump, and, you know, because of the inauguration, and the rest of the media wasn't paying attention. And then I just got this one extra clue that put me on this story, that turned into what, you know, in the book, Newt Gingrich says this is the biggest scandal in congressional history. But it kind of played out with people, the media, having this kind of pack mentality that was focused on other things. And so really what the story, and I didn't set out with any kind of predetermined conclusion. I just kind of followed the clues from what right. seemed like a little cyber breach and saw where it took me. But by the end of it, it was funny, because what this really is a story about all the things that the whole Robert Mueller, all the things that Robert Mueller and the media said we were going to find about Russia, they actually were occurring at the very same time. And by that I mean a hack of our computer system, foreign meddling, and collusion. I mean, all these things, these sort of cloak and dagger things. And I get why people were interested in this whole Russia thing, because if it were a movie, if it were a fictional movie, you would watch that movie about, like, what if a president, you know, like, what if a politician was being blackmailed?
Right.
The problem is it was all made up in this case about, you know, like, but the odd thing is there really was a very, very similar story happening at the very same time involving Debbie Wasserman Schultz's IT guy, Imran Awan, and, you know, basically the misconduct that he was doing on Capitol Hill that involved other members of Congress. And then when this story threatened to break and kind of derail the Russian narrative, because it happened, actually, you know, I found out about it during the inauguration, but when this really was happening and the FBI was involved in everything, this basically, the hack of the computer network in Congress was detected in June of 2016, 2 days after the DNC was hacked. And so the Inspector General of Congress realized, holy cow, Congress is being hacked. She traces it back, and she finds who's doing it. It's Debbie Wasserman Schultz's IT person. And, of course, he works in Congress, but then he's going and he's taking other data that he doesn't have any access to and for people he doesn't work for, and funneling it off the network. And so from the beginning, you had these startling parallels of same week the DNC is hacked, Wasserman Schultz's IT guys caught hacking Congress, And actually, the main computer he was hacking was the DNC's sister group called the House Democratic Caucus. And from there, that's when it starts to go off the rails. Nancy Pelosi frames the IG on ethics charges and drives her out of government.
That's the Inspector General. Yes. Go ahead.
Correct. And she was, the Inspector General was actually appointed by Nancy Pelosi back when she was in charge the last time around.
So she frames her. What do you mean she frames her?
So the book goes into detail about it, but the book, you know, basically Pelosi works through this employee that she has, this top operator who's like the chief of staff of a committee that handles all of her dirty work. She's her fixer, basically.
What's his name?
And, you know, I want to leave a little curiosity.
Oh, okay, okay.
But you know,
no, people have to read this book. No matter what you say here, Luke, people have to read this book.
Well, so the book is interesting because it shows you who's doing the real things in Washington.
Exactly.
It does involve the top
You do
people,
name names.
It also involves all the low-level people. The people who are really running Washington and who have a lot of power, most people have never heard of, and that's important.
Yes.
If you really want to figure out how these things are going on, you got to know who really wields the power. So she works through this fixer that knows all the ins and outs of Congress. And, you know, he basically you know, long story short, the inspector general had given a speech abroad and disclosed properly, and it was all very on the up and up. And he made it seem like she was colluding with a foreign government, and he's going to have her criminally charged for violating the Logan Act, and, you know, all this stuff. And they tried to take away her budget through various, like, maneuvering, and, you know, basically they just drive her out.
Just by, so she won't look into this.
Correct. And she's been there for, I forget, more than 20 years. And this is, like, kind of the case, that the one case where she has revealed, she is on the precipice of revealing sort of this tumor in the middle of the House of Representatives. And they stop her. And so the book is kind of two narratives that are interwoven. And the first is this very Machiavellian, manipulative, cutthroat, but also charming guy named Imran Awam. And, you know, he can, you know, you would like him if you met him. He's charming and he talks his way into Congress, but
Those psychopaths always are charming.
Yeah. Yeah, he is a psychopath. And yeah, I mean, he would, you know, his relatives said, you know, look, he would kill his own mom for a penny. Like, that's the kind of guy this guy is. He has no compassion for anyone. It's all about getting money and advancing at all costs. And so, you know, he's basically stealing from Congress, and then he's stealing money, and then he's stealing data, and then he's, like, threatening people that have the potential to expose him. And so that's one thing here, all this crazy stuff that he's doing. And he's going over to Pakistan and dealing with foreign officials there and threatening people over there. And then the other thing is the cover. It's a story about the cover-up, which is at least as interesting. And that's when you've got the Democrats who are, you know, presumably not psychopaths, presumably not like these crazy guys, this crazy. They're people that are equally, though, manipulative and, you know, scheming. And they do know all the, you know, when we talk about, like, the deep state, it's like you kind of know all the little ins and outs in government, all the little back doors, all the people you can talk to, all the loopholes. And you see how they very deliberately start scheming and manipulating and plotting and misleading in order to cause a situation such that even though everyone on Capitol Hill knows that these Pakistani guys have been caught hacking Congress, they are not arrested until after the election. And even then, they are never charged for the actual substantive crimes that is, it is well documented that they did.
Now, what did they hack? What information did they get?
So they hacked, you know, basically all the emails and files of a fifth of Congress. About 50 Democrats, every email they ever sent, every email they ever received, say any file that was on either their computers or their staff computers. And they could even send emails as congressmen and pretend to be them. And, you know, basically, you know, there are obviously national security implications, but then as I began researching more about these guys, it became clear that they were blackmailers, and that was what their primary MO was, is extortion. And you think about how, you know, in addition to the national security stuff, you also have the politically compromising or personally compromising nature of, if you had all of a congressman's emails, they probably don't want that stuff coming out there. And so, you know, in the early days of this story, Congress was so suspicious, and I knew that, you know, they were so secretive about this. And I knew that they had documented hundreds of thousands of dollars of theft from that these guys had been stealing, of computers and money. And then I knew that they had documented that they were hacking Congress, impersonating members of Congress, and yet there were no charges.
They were impersonating members of Congress to buy these computers and other expensive supplies, right? And then they would just take them home and sell them, right?
And yeah, exactly. And they knew all the ins and outs. And so, like, you know, in Congress, they have, like, really, like any business, there's such thing as petty cash, where if it's under a certain amount, they don't really
track it. $500, right?
Right. And so what they did is they would buy whatever they wanted, say a computer that cost $2,000 or a big screen TV that cost $1,500, and they would change the receipt so that it said that it cost $499. And so then they said, well, we don't need to track this anymore. And so it's just classic fraud. I mean, it's straight up falsification of government records to steal hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, you know, the House knew that they did this. They got all the paperwork and they said, no, of course this expensive computer doesn't really cost $499. It's fraud. And they go and they look, and sure enough, everything that they bought that way is missing. And so it starts as a theft investigation. But then they say, well, wait a minute. An IT guy doesn't have the authority to purchase, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of things. They have to obviously check with the congressman, or at least the congressman's chief of staff. And so they realize that these guys were working with one or more congressional members of Congress or chiefs of staff to do this theft, this financial theft. And the first thing that they figured out is there's a congresswoman, she's still in office, named Yvette Clark from Brooklyn. And so her Congress, her chief of staff, had been working with the IT guy to steal, in her case, like $120,000 of equipment in about a year. And so that's a tenth of her budget. You know, the congressman, $120,000 can't just walk out the door. The budgets are pretty small. So that's enough for like 10 computers for every staffer that she had. So
wow.
How does Congresswoman Yvette Clark not realize that she's bought 10 computers for every single one of her staff? It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And so that's when you start to see, well, so this started as a money scheme, and the congressman knew about it, but then these IT guys, they've gotten greedy, or they've escalated, and now they've moved on from stealing just money to they're stealing data. And then they get caught, but what is kind of implied and what the congressman would have known is, hey, well, if we really go after these guys for the theft and the national security stuff that we legitimately care about and are frightened by, once you start peeling back the layer of the onion, or really just once these guys squeal on us to try to, you know, save themselves, congressmen are going to be implicated in a fraud scheme.
Yep.
And so you have this really interesting dynamic where they have to choose between national security and their own political reputations. And now stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars is actually what it was from Congress. That's a pretty bad thing. That's a big deal in itself. But it's not as bad as the national security thing. And what it turns out is these congressmen would rather have us be subject to a national security breach than to lose their political careers over, you know, theft.
I mean, this is just breathtaking. And go ahead.
What has happened in your life, Luke, since the book came out? Has there been backlash?
No, I mean, no one's ever pointed out a single, you know, error in the book. There are no errors.
I bet they're being real quiet.
Yeah, which tactic are they using? Is it to be dead silent and pretend nobody, and hope nobody notices or buys your book or makes a splash about it?
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean, they can't dispute anything in the book. They just have to pretend it's not out there. And, you know, it was basically an incredibly detailed book that wasn't impossible to, I think, that, you know.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing where if you haven't read it and you're like, oh, that guy, he worked for the Daily Caller, or like, he's probably conservative, the book subtitle has the word Democrats in it, maybe it's just some partisan thing, but then you read it, and like you said, and I can tell you guys have read it, it's a very, very detailed book that names, even at the low level. And there's also really nothing partisan about it, because it's pretty negative towards Paul Ryan and the other kind of incumbent forces of, you know, it's basically, it's a sad story in a lot of ways, because a lot of people in Washington knew that this was going on and that this was one of the biggest scandals in Washington's history. And each of them said, well, you know, I got a nice, comfortable life. I don't really want to disrupt it. Yeah, I saw the key piece of evidence here, but I don't want to be the one to come forward. It should really be someone else's job. Mm. You know, and a lot of people thought, in fact, the Nancy Pelosi's people told the Republicans that, like, the CIA was involved, the FBI is on it, so don't you say anything and don't you poke around because you might mess up their investigation. So there
that's
a lot
of classic.
Trickery and, you know, and at some point you have to think, look, the Republicans should have known better. You know, the Democrats are doing a lot of tricks, but the Republicans, they're just...
Well, the other thing is, too, is I'm sure everybody in Congress If it's happening to the Democrats, the Republicans are like, well, we'd like to stick it to them. But by the same token, if we were in that position, and we could very easily be in that position, we'd like them to do us the courtesy of sort of not doing too much, too, you know?
That's exactly what they said. And then they also turned it into, like, an executive branch against legislative branch thing, like, hey, you know, we've got the separation of powers here, and we got to stick together. You know, you don't want to be turning. And they actually made a law. They passed it into law. That Congress, that the FBI cannot investigate a hack of Congress, should Congress ever be hacked.
That is just ridiculous.
Without the consent of the minority party. And so right after this came out, or right after, you know, the IG was being fired and things like that, they slipped it into law as like one sentence in, you know, a 2,000-page bill.
But that, it so said, that in itself is an obstruction of justice move.
Exactly. and so, you know, it really is like a movie when you read this book, and I think it's a cool book because I was glad to turn it into a book form, because it is complicated, which is part of probably, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, it wasn't like a major news story when this was unfolding, but you know, it is both kind of a Watergate caliber investigation.
Yep.
Almost that's,
yep,
kind of fun to read about, but then there's also just this narrative, it is fun to read. It's almost like reading a novel.
It's a page turner for sure.
It's true.
So, so let me ask you something, because, you know, as an investigative reporter, I'm sure all three of us can agree that, you know, when you're working on something like this, certain things happen, and you have what your reptilian brain, what I call my reptilian brain, kicks in, and I'm like, oh, this is an interesting coincidence. Oh, you know, whatever. And sometimes the reptilian brain is wrong, and sometimes it's right. And does your reptilian brain say anything about how the timing of the Mueller investigation and this? Because there's this weird, you know, there are operations that do that you know, it's a classic
bait and switch.
Well, no, to accuse your enemy, and investigate your enemy for doing the crime that you yourself are engaging in.
What do I mean? That's
so, because the Mueller could you talk about, okay, whether, you know, whether you have entertained that notion or not, but also
Rules for Radicals. What's his name? Help me out.
Saul
Alinsky. Thank you.
So, you know, I mean, I was struck when you said that, and you know, we have on this radio show, we've been looking at this Mueller investigation, and it really feels like an operation as opposed to a real investigation. So I was just wondering, since you're a computer guy, and also what you think of what Bill Binney and that IBM guy, you know, they came and they looked at the forensic evidence that was made available on the DNC hack, and they're saying, look, this was not done by the Russians. Could you talk about that whole ball of wax?
Yeah, I mean, so like in the summer of 2016, you basically had Fusion GPS like feeding stories to the media and trying to get them to write stories that in turn would be used to justify an FBI investigation, and then eventually they got them to write stories that the FBI was invested. The whole thing was very circular and very deliberately implanted, and you know, and then at the same time, what you had is, you know, an actual hack, and the media and the Democrats were similarly conspiring to work the media to say, you know, don't write about it, and here's all the reasons you shouldn't write about it. And, you know, you have in one case the basically to create a crime where none exists, and then one is playing out right then, and it's like two tiers of justice. I mean,
remind our listeners about Fusion GPS, just, you know, who was funding
it? I mean, you know, the DNC, which is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, was paying Fusion GPS, which was a team of Oppo researchers tied to the Wall Street Journal. And so they, you know, paid for this dossier,
right,
you know, from this British spy.
Steel.
And then they fed the dossier to the FBI. And that's how this whole investigation started. And there was never anything to the investigation, but they got the media to write stories, Not that Trump actually did do something with, you know, prostitutes in Russia, but that the FBI was investigating whether he did. And that was the little trick that Fusion GPS used. And then, so meanwhile, in the case of the Awan brothers, it's all documented, everything they did. But there was no criminal charges because they rigged it on the FBI and DOJ side.
What about,
and so then,
go ahead.
Well, what they got the media to do is take the position that because there's no charges, none of this occurred. And so they would say, well, and I would print all the evidence in my stories. And, you know, my sources included Imran Awan's wife and his mother and, you know, his stepmother, like family members, sworn testimony from the many lawsuits they had been. And so I would print these things, and people would say, you know, the New York Times would say, well, conservative media claimed that Imran Awan did this or that. And I would say, conservative media doesn't claim it. I told you, the court records, you can go look at them yourself. And so they had a way of marginalizing it, and they said, well, surely if he actually did hack Congress and if members of Congress were involved in a theft scheme and so on, they would be charged. And so that's what it comes down to, is the media willfully taking the position, instead of questioning the government, instead of investigating based on primary sources, they took the position of just basically being like bootlickers for the government, which is really bizarre to me because that's not why I got into journalism. And so, you know, there are documents that show that they did all these things. Most of these things are, you know, paper, like, records and documents. But there was no charges, and, you know, for a lot of journalists, that's what it comes down to, is what is the FBI doing? What is the FBI not doing? And that's kind of one of the big disconnects that's exposed here. It's like, Can we trust our justice system anymore? Because it really, the politicization that we've seen with Peter Stroke and Bruce Orr and Fusion GPS and all those things, it is not, in my experience, it's more expansive than we knew.
Yes.
And so that's kind of the question here, is when people say, you know, they hear about Hillary's email servers and all this Russia stuff and all the stuff we've been talking about, they hear it a million times a day on conservative media and liberal media. But the question has to be, like, if these people are that corrupt and they're lying to you all the time, like, don't you think there's stuff out there that you don't know about at all? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Well, this is
don't know it all now because we know that Peter Strzok, whatever. Like, and so the Awan brothers is an example of the thing that the average person and most of the media didn't know existed, but it's every bit as big as these other scandals, and it's, in fact, it was just, they were better at it. They were more successful at covering it up, and that's why, you know, most people haven't heard about it.
Luke, could you tell us, or tell our listeners and us, how did these brothers make their way into our government to begin with, and how did they evade significant background checks?
Well, they came over using the diversity lottery and then using chain migration. They brought their whole family over, just huge numbers of people. And then, you know, Imran Awan married his own cousin to bring her over. And so he was this very charming guy, as I said, but also very vicious and money-driven. And he started living in this community in Fairfax County, Virginia, that was very... they weren't integrating, you know, this was all a Pakistani community in this apartment complex. And he started working as a faith healer, if you can believe it, like a witch doctor, basically.
No.
And so he would find people that were dying of cancer, and he would go to their wives and be like, you know, your husband's almost dead. If you give me $20,000, I'll do a little chant on him, and then he'll be saved. And so he would really kind of come on to the women a little bit and like, flirt with them and become, like, appear charming. And they would turn over their life savings, believing they had no other choice, and he was going to save their life. And so, of course, the people then, these are like kind of low-educated Pakistani immigrants in Virginia. Of course, they don't seek medical treatment because they say, oh, no, he's going to be fixed. He had a chance. And so people died. This is when Imran Awan first comes over, and he's like in high school and in early teen, you know, like early adulthood. He's killing people to steal money by lying about who he is. And he's got a false name. He says that he was basically from one of the elite classes in Pakistan that is considered to have all these spiritual powers. And it was a lie. I mean, that wasn't who he was. And so that's kind of a weird introduction, I know. But it shows who he is. He's kind of a crazy guy that's charming but also just a total liar and would kill you to get money. And so he uses that charm, and he's very, very hardworking because he's so driven to get money. He does eventually get an IT degree, and he talks his way into Congress as a contractor where you didn't have to be a citizen or do a background check because you were a contractor. And then he immediately, somehow, he gets this congressman, Robert Wexler, to, like, bully the company, to let him violate his non-compete and start his own company and then start working for Congress as a W-2 employee, a direct employee. And he's not even a citizen, and they hire him anyway. They give him access to all the data for this one congressional office. And then over time, he continues to use this charm and whatever other influence he wields mysteriously over congressmen. And they start putting his entire family on the payroll, even though his family members aren't working there.
And they so do. He puts them on, and also none of them have IT experience or degrees or anything.
This
right.
Is
right.
So, so crazy.
If you look at their
this
resume,
is so crazy.
I mean, one of them was working at McDonald's.
Yeah.
And you know, so the rules say that you have to do a background check when you hire an IT guy. And
I would hope so.
All congressmen who hired these guys violated their own rules. They never, not one person.
I just have to keep saying why. I mean, what is the underlying pathology here that caused all of these breaches, all of these people to be asleep? Now, could you go back to those?
Did they know this was going? But there was more than just one congressperson
on the
take.
I want to go back to how
they were on the take. Some of them were on the take when he was buying this equipment. That's how he expanded his empire there.
Right, and the reason that they put the no-show employees on the payroll is they got $7 million that way, and they were all being paid as much as a congressman. So they were being paid as much as chiefs of staff, as much as congressmen. That's unheard of. The IT guy does not make as much as a congressman.
Just
logically, that's just absurd to think about. And yet, that's when they filled out these invoices, they were not only was Imran Awam being paid as much as a congressman, his seven relatives were too, including McDonald's, including a high school student.
Now, what year or years was this all set up? What year did they begin all
this? It started in like 2005, and like Debbie Wasserman Schultz was the second employer that he ever got. So,
but
she
was kicking back to these congresspeople, wasn't he? I mean,
yeah, I mean that's, you know, certainly what's implied here, because
so
that's
this
the
is
only
under
way
George W. Bush. This is happening.
And, you know, because for people that, I know it's fun to think about how the government is bloated, but, like, for people that are familiar with Capitol Hill is not bloated. Like, they have very austere budgets, and there's just no way that you can put, like, three IT guys on your payroll without noticing and then pay them all the same as chief of staff. It cannot happen. There's fierce competition for these jobs. There are people working there with law degrees who are making $30,000 a year. And so It's that's the kind of thing that was self-evident to the insiders, to people that work on Capitol Hill and are familiar with the area. When this came up, everyone immediately realized that this could not have happened without congressmen being involved in it for, you know, presumably for kickback.
Talk about Debbie Wasserman. What's her whole role here? And, you know, here she also presides over this other hack. What's the deal with her?
So, you know, like, as I mentioned, the hack first, the Awam brothers first came onto the radar of authorities the same week as the DNC was hacked. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz at that point had been embarrassed for not handling the DNC hack properly. But what did she do? She immediately began frantically running for cover, for frantically protecting her IT guy, which is not, it's not credible. Because
didn't she threaten a cop, Washington cop?
Yeah, that's
could
video.
You talk about that, what she did?
Yeah, we should definitely get to those. So I'll run through some of the highlights of sort of the most insane events of the book. So they stall after they find out, they wait until after the election, and they know that they have hacked this Democratic National Committee. This House Democratic Caucus server. And so after the inauguration, the cops belatedly go in to fetch the evidence, and it's gone. The server that these guys had hacked had physically disappeared. They had stolen the entire thing, hard drives and all, and walked it out of the building. And so at that point, you have literally like a felony hacking probe open in the House of Representatives by the FBI, and they know that the key evidence has been stolen, which is obviously obstruction of justice, evidence tampering, and they still decide, well, obviously we have to do something now, but we're not going to arrest them. We're just going to ask them not to work here anymore. We're going to deactivate their we're going to, you know, say you can't access the computers anymore. So Debbie Wasserman Schultz lets him keep coming into Congress anyway. She doesn't take away his badge. And it turns out that, you know, because congressmen basically are in charge of their own offices, it's not possible for the authorities to say a congressman can't hire someone. So they're saying, look, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, these guys are hackers. We're going to arrest them any day now. You got to get them off. And she says, you can't make me. And they say, maybe technically we can't make you, but you're putting our nation at risk.
Why does she do and that?
It doesn't make any sense short of blackmail. And so,
Short of blackmail, it does not make sense. You're absolutely.
You know, I mean, and the other thing is, of course, that you know, if her IT guy is arrested, everyone immediately assumes that he's also. First of all, it looks bad on her because she hired him and failed to vet him, broke the rules by not doing a background check, and then also there are questions raised about the DNC hack. Did he do that one too? And everyone's mind immediately goes to that, and so she doesn't. It's easier for it to let this guy get away with it than to have him be caught because it makes the Democrats look bad and it's a distraction from the Russian narrative. So there's multiple reasons, but blackmail is a big one. And so he still has the keys to the Congress office building even when he's banned. And he comes in, and this is right after Debbie Wasserman Schultz has helped him. He comes in at midnight when he's not supposed to be there, steals her laptop, and leaves it in a phone booth for police to find. With his business card on top, and they find it and they say, so this is a guy that's banned from Congress.
He's a
hacking suspect. He's stolen Debbie Wasserman Schultz's laptop and he's left it in a phone booth. Like, what is this?
That's his message to Debbie. You better protect me or else, right?
That's exactly right. And he put a little note on top that said attorney-client privilege. And it's ridiculous because the legal system doesn't actually work this way. But in this case, it did. He says, well, you know, it's up to, if you stay on my good side, I'll claim attorney-client privilege and they won't be able to look at that laptop. But if I waive it, all that's going out into the public. And so, you know, and so Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the top Democrat on the panel that is in charge, the committee that's in charge of the Capitol Police budget. And so they have a hearing right after this happens, and she says that she's going to take away all the Capitol Police's funding and disband their entire board unless the chief of police gives back her laptop. Without looking at it. And the chief of police says, are you kidding me? This is a hacking investigation. Don't you want us to help? You know, don't you want to let us help you? Don't you want the evidence to be known so we can prosecute bad guys? And she says, if you don't give this back to me, I swear I will disband the entire Capitol Police board so that they'll have no choice but to, you know, fire you and we'll have new top people, everything. It was really quite over the top and, like, not so, it wasn't subtle. It was not normal at all. And so, eventually she doesn't get her way. She freaks out. She threatens the cops, and then it goes to the prosecutors. Well, the thing is, Debbie Wasserman Schultz's brother works in the very prosecutor's office that's handling this, and he starts, like, sending tweets and stuff, you know, basically taking his sister's side and mocking the idea that there's anything to this case. And as for whatever else he might be doing behind the scenes, I mean, we don't know, but we can only imagine. And so then, Imran Awan, it turns out, that he still has access to all the data and stuff, even though he's been banned from the network because he has stolen, he has a fake email address. Basically, they shut down his real one, and they don't realize that he has an email address called 123@mail.house.gov that's still giving him access to the computer system. And the reason they didn't shut that down is because 123@mail.house.gov wasn't listed in his name. He had listed it in the name of an Intelligence Committee staffer for Andre Carson, who's a member of the Intelligence Committee. And so this was, you know, of all the people to steal their identity, you're going to pick an Intelligence Committee staffer. And the whole thing was so, so frightening that this had happened. And the reason I found out about it was because I obtained emails where he was writing to people from 123. And then I went down to court. He had been sued. And he had listed that as his email address. And so it was documented in, of all things, government documents.
Unbelievable.
That this was, and, you know, that was kind of ignored as well. But, and then, you know, it just kind of goes on and on like that.
What's the disposition of this situation now? Where is Awan and, you know, all these other people who helped him out or covered up for him, including Debbie? Is she going to be held accountable? I mean, what's going on with...
No one's going to be held accountable, and that's why this is the book kind of ends as, you know, there is no justice for these guys. The question is there going to be any justice for the sort of the FBI and the DOJ and maybe the congressman that let this happen? Because what happened is, you know, basically a Hillary Clinton lawyer came on the scene and said that he's representing Imran Awan. Why Hillary Clinton's people would want to get involved in representing an accused hacker, I don't know. But he starts, the lawyer is very aggressive. He starts lying, threatening witnesses. Evidence disappears, and the FBI gives him full immunity to this guy, Imran Awan.
The FBI, you know, gives him full immunity?
Yeah.
Why?
The DOJ did, for no reason whatsoever. I mean, they knew, they had all the proof of everything he had done. And they said, you know, if you plead guilty to this minor, like, thing, basically, so what happened is, and I didn't get to this part, the heat starts getting on him because all the stuff we mentioned, and they start tailing him, and he, you know, his wife flees the country with $11,000 in a suitcase. And they stop her at the airport, and then they find the $11,000, which he's hidden and lied about, and they let her leave anyway. It's like they wanted these people to get out of the country so they could just get this over with. And then he flees the country with $9,000 in his suitcase, and, you know, he tries to flee, and they arrest him at the airport. But they only charge him with, you know, basically flees. He tries to steal, like, a couple $100,000 on his way out the door to, like, create a new life in Pakistan, and they just charge him with the money stuff, but not the stuff that he was fleeing from to begin with.
Oh my God.
So it doesn't make any sense, because they knew he was fleeing, and that's why they were following him to begin with. But why would you charge him with the cover-up but not the crime? And so they had a situation where I think they wanted this guy in jail because they were really frightened about what they knew happened, but they didn't want it to be on record, the full extent of what he had done. And so they charge him with only a minor thing, and they say, if you plead guilty to that, we'll, you know, give you full immunity. But then that's when his own relatives start coming forward and saying, look, his wife came forward and said, not only to me, but she did come to me, but also she came to the FBI and said, look, this is an extortionist. This is someone who threatens to have people killed if they don't do what he says. This is someone who hacked Congress and is blackmailing Congress and who had stolen all their data. And so his wife comes forward, his very own wife, and says all that. And so, you know, the FBI, and then basically everything that she said, the cops, quote, accidentally give it to Imran Awan's lawyer. And so the evidence, you know, witnesses have been exposed, they're being intimidated, you know, the lawyer puts Imran Awan on his payroll so that he has special access to all the evidence. The whole thing is very weird. But, you know, what you have by the end of it is Democrats are coming forward and saying this guy's horrible, his own wife, all of his relatives who are, of course, Pakistani and Muslim like him, because the Democrats are, of course, trying to say, well, this must be partisan, this must be racist, this must be, oddly enough, they say anti-female. And when you read the book and you look at the details, like, it's you see how absurd that is. And you see a lot of times when people say things are racist or whatever, and they're trying to shift accountability for the facts at hand.
Absolutely.
Because
it's
so absurd. I mean, his wife was, and the book kind of opens with, it's like 4th of July, and I'm meeting with his wife, and he's just been given immunity and let off the hook. And his wife is just like, I don't understand. Like, I fled Pakistan because it was very corrupt here, there over in Pakistan. And I thought things were supposed to not be corrupt in America. I mean, that's sort of the mythology. And I just, my heart broke for her, and I said, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, this is the most corrupt thing I've ever seen. She's, of course, worried that she's going to be killed because she came forward, thinking if she came forward, he would definitely be put in jail for life.
Right.
And instead, he was protected, and now he's going to retaliate against her. So at the end of the day, you know, he's over in Pakistan with $7 million stolen from Congress, and he's a very, he's been emboldened, I'm sure, by this situation, which is frightening to people who know him, who says he thinks he's invincible now, it's gone to his head, he's going to retaliate, he thinks he's God, he thinks he can do anything. So this is kind of a madman that, you know, was protected, and he has all our data, and he, you know, the book gets into how he took money from a Hezbollah at the time that he stole evidence, stole data from intelligence people, and you know, how he gave a USB of data to Pakistani intel. I mean, this is, you know, there's a financial component, but he was also selling it to people abroad. And, you know, this is our national security was, this was a major, major security breach. And because of political concerns, it was whitewashed from history.
So we know he was a greedy, psychopathic, essentially, killer. What do you know about his politics? How much of this was fueled by...
It's just money. It's just money.
Well, that's what,
Celia,
I'm asking. Well, we don't know. I mean...
It's pretty clear, I think, don't you? I don't know. You can tell us.
Well, money isn't politics. His ideology.
Exactly.
His ideology is what I'm talking about.
I think his ideology is money.
Yeah, no, I do too. And if I had set out to write as the Democrats claim, you know, probably wanted to portray it, that I was just some partisan person trying to traffic in like stereotypes or whatever, like, you know, I would have said that this is like a motivated, he's a terrorist and he's motivated by ideology. Like, that's not the facts that I came across.
Okay.
In literally two
okay.
and a half years of talking to the people that know him best.
Because he really comes in and just really attacks this country, really, you know, just guts our country.
I have to say, the more deeply concerning thing about this, the bigger picture that you bring into focus that freaks me out, is the fact that our entire justice system, our investigative and law enforcement services, be it the FBI, the CIA, the Justice Department, our Congress, they're all beholden to something other than their original mission, which is to protect the American people, to enforce the law, to deal with crime. And in this case, it's like these institutions have become sort of political battlegrounds, you know? I mean, if this had happened to, you know, it's not even left or right anymore. These institutions and these leaders they're sort of institutions under themselves. Their first mission is to protect themselves, cover their own asses. And we pay for this, okay? We paid that $7 million to the taxpayer, okay? And so it's like what you've exposed here are how, you know, the FBI, you know, whatever political they behaved in a political manner. The Department of Justice behaved in a political manner. Everybody was in on this cover up.
Well, I want to say what that freaks me out, and there's something else that freaks me out and has for decades, and that is the weaponization of political correctness and identity politics, which plays out very much in this story. What? Why do you look backwards?
I don't understand.
Because as Luke just told us, that the idea that they were Muslim and they were that nobody wanted to touch that. Or am I with you, Luke? Is that
yeah absolutely. This that's exactly right. And that this story has so many important themes. I mean, about national security, about the deep state and the way that people protect their institutions, protect themselves, about the news media and how they have completely failed to do real investigations anymore, and about
it's like you can't touch certain people. Do you not see that, Christine?
No, Celia always makes a point that I think is really great when we talk to our guests. She's always talking about how the press essentially is the big weapon for neutralizing any accountability.
And they tell us who we can touch and who we can't, can look at, who we can't.
So could you talk about that, but also talk about, I mean, didn't any journalist colleague say anything to you? Did you have any conversations with journalists about, you know, why is this not being covered? Why is it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing the extent that they went to not write about this. And I would show them, you know.
Who did you show?
And, you know, I showed, you know, well, so let me say this. Some of the sources that came to me in the early days, mm-hmm. they were Democrats, right? Because these guys, the Yuan brothers only worked for Democrats, and so the people that knew them best and knew all the incriminating stuff were Democrats. Those sources were very, very afraid of our national security because, you know, and they came to the Washington Post first, and the Washington Post would not get back to them. And I saw what they sent to the Washington Post. It was a story that any legitimate reporter would want to know, and it was coming from high-level Democrats who were well-positioned to be sources. And so these guys reluctantly came to me because I worked for the Daily Caller. I wasn't their first choice for a Democrat to come to. And so from the beginning, the press was willfully incurious about this. And when I started doing enough reporting that it frankly seemed completely insane, this was clearly such a serious issue that it had to be addressed, then they said, well, it's a conspiracy theory because they haven't been charged, and clearly if someone had done all these crazy things, they would have been charged. And so that's been kind of a lot of the press has, instead of holding government accountable and pulling on that thread and finding things that are just that thrill of the pursuit, they have taken upon themselves to think like their job is to like try to tear down stories that do not fit their preferred narrative. And no one ever did tear the story down. I mean, it is a complicated story, and I could talk about it all day, and if people try to rebut it, then I'll explain why they're wrong. But they don't really do that. They just kind of summarize the whole thing wrong and just say that it's a conspiracy theory. And if I try to say, well, let's talk about that, they say, I don't really have time or the interest. So, it was really, it made me think, like, man, what? Because I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I'm usually a pretty skeptical person, but like, man, what else is going on out there that the media has refused to tell us about?
Oh,
I want to read.
You know, there are lots and lots. These types of stories, these huge stories, and by the way, the cover-ups follow a playbook. Okay, I mean, all the cover-ups that you've seen here. You've seen in other major stories too, Luke. Somebody should actually write the book, the cover up playbook, and I'll be happy to
Christina
contribute to
Borgeson
it.
Should write that book. I want to read a quote from Tucker Carlson from the back of your book. Rosiak is one of the smartest, most diligent reporters in Washington, and this book is a testament to his skills. Future historians trying to make sense of the unprecedented deception and insanity we're now living through will be reading Luke Rosiak. So again, everybody, obstruction of justice, how the deep state risked national security to protect the Democrats.
By the way,
and also wait before, how can people, we're not out of time yet, but we have 10 minutes. How can people find you? And if you could give us your social media info and that kind of thing.
This book is, you know, you can get it wherever, Amazon, it should be in Barnes and Noble stores. And it's, again, obstruction of justice, how the deep state risks national security to protect the Democrats. I'm on Twitter at Luke Rosiak. My last name is Rosiak.
Okay.
Daily Caller reporter, by day, and I guess author by night.
So I am interested in your assessment of the alleged DNC hack. Have you looked into that at all? Have you looked at what the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity did with the forensic evidence? What is your assessment so far, based on what you know or have seen or, you know?
I'm familiar with that report too. That says that the data was transferred at such a speed that it had to be someone with physical access. When I was doing all this reporting, I tried to stay away from the DNC stuff because that's how they would try to.
Yes.
You were just talking about how the media would try to smear me, and they would try. And there are all these, like the Daily Beast. I think even the New York Times. They say, "Oh, the Daily Caller claims that Imran Awan stole the DNC emails." Like, that's
so they
not
conflated
what I said.
The two stories, huh?
They did. That's what they do. That's part of that playbook that you're talking about. Is they conflate and then they say something that you never said, and they said, "Well, that's false." Well, I never said that. I wrote 80 stories about Imran Awan, and not once did it say he stole the DNC emails. It said that he hacked Congress, which is separate. But there is that question, which is, I think, part of what fueled the cover-up, is whether he did or did not steal the DNC emails. If he would have been arrested for hacking Congress, that would have been on everyone's mind. And as you said, the media is what's so important. The media has more power than any government agency because it's what,
it controls public perception.
Exactly. And so they didn't. They couldn't have even the perception that this guy stole the DNC emails. Now, the book does go into some evidence that, you know, basically one of these sources that did approach the Washington Post, too, said, you know, that this guy, Imran Awan, went to the DNC every year. And even though he wasn't on the payroll, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was basically having him work there for free so that she could bill taxpayers and then have him do, like, political work rather than needing to use funding because the DNC didn't have much funding. And so that would have given him an illicit spot at the DNC that they couldn't reveal because they were doing campaign finance fraud. You know, and as for whether, you know, beyond that, I don't know.
You said they were doing campaign finance fraud? What do you mean by that?
Well, so if Imran Awan was working at the DNC, which this one guy says that he was being paid by taxpayers. He wasn't on the DNC's payroll. He shouldn't have been working
there.
Oh,
okay.
And so that's a way to basically, instead of, you know, using donors' funds to pay the DNC employees, they bill them to taxpayers. But, you know, as I said, my book doesn't engage in really any speculation. It sticks to things that are 100% documented, which is what I think people will be shocked at. So the DNC thing, I try to limit the discussion of that because it's not necessary to build the case that this is one of the biggest scandals in congressional history, if you know what I mean.
Yes, no, I think every American should read this book. You know, I think that you have really done yeoman's work here with this book, and I'm sure you're still following the denouement of this thing, aren't you? I mean, are you following
are you feeling demoralized by just the whole culture we live in that you find it difficult?
Yeah, I am. And you know, like I was, you know, when I was writing the book, you know, I said I did try to write it a little bit like a novel. I said, you know, if there's a feeling behind this book, it's almost one of sadness.
Yeah.
It's one of demoralization and sadness because they have this thing rigged at all levels.
Ugh.
And, you know, the Republicans were in charge of Congress at the time, and they have this guy, like Phil Kiko, that's like in charge of Congress's back office. And, you know, because he helped this go away, Nancy Pelosi said, we'll keep him on. So now you've got a Republican in a top position in Congress. Why did Nancy Pelosi hire a Republican? It's because he got to keep his job for making this thing go away. And so you have people, they have institutions that exist just to protect themselves. But then what you also have is that individuals will always choose their own personal career and their own personal reputation over doing the right thing. And so there's kind of the introduction of this book says, you know, a lot of people basically they turned a blind eye to this, but there were some heroes that, and unfortunately that the heroes they got, I forget the exact sentence, but it's one I like, you know, the heroes of this book were shot at, retaliated, forced out of their job, threatened, harassed, abused, and like all those things are literally true. I mean, people were shot at, you know, people were framed on criminal charges, all for just bearing witness to something that they had no reason to make up and no reason to really come forward with, except that they wanted to do the right thing for America. And it turns out that, yeah, they have it rigged so that there's no incentive to do the right thing and there's every incentive to do the wrong thing.
Well, I want to say that there's no reason to be discouraged when people like you are on the case. I mean, this is one, you know, big spotlight on a situation that eventually, it may not happen today, won't happen tomorrow, maybe not in a few years, but you have put a hole in the dike for sure with this book. And I know it feels right now maybe like, you know, it's not happening, you know, it's not making an impact. But I think it is making a bigger impact.
It's not happening in the propaganda machine.
It's not happening in the propaganda machine, but this is breaking it down.
Yeah. And, you know, when people talk about the liberal media and things like that, and they do a lot of complaining, rightfully so, but one of the things that we can do is we can read stuff that's outside of the main, outside of liberal media. And, you know, so reading this book, and I know these days, you know, it takes 5 or 6 hours to read a book. That's something you can do here to become an informed citizen and break out of that echo chamber, because, you know, it took 2.5 years of investigating. This is kind of a real investigative, resource-heavy thing. And this is, you know, being informed, that's what it's all about, is just documenting this stuff, being informed, and then holding them accountable and saying, not only did this happen, but we can show you that the FBI knew it happened and they did nothing. And eventually, well, maybe we're going to have some accountability.
So the publishing industry is, in a sense, a compensation for what we're calling the propaganda machine. Still get a book out if you can't get the Washington Post to...
Right. Well, we're going to have to wrap up, but, I just want to say that when I said that you are a reporter after our own hearts, you are. Doesn't matter whether it's left or right. It's what the truth is, whatever wing that flies in on. Thanks for being with us.
I agree. Thank you for having me.
Rebels and mutineers.